you. And now, would you care to make any comments 25 years after that first broadcast? That broadcast?
Yes, looking back on the United Nations since Dag Hammarskjöld's death, I would say that Hammarskjöld's greatest fault was his dedication to finding the answer to what he believed was man's greatest prayer, which asks not for victory but for peace. In a day when victory is still our goal, even though there can be no victory, this peacemaker was sacrificed. And so will the UN be one of these days on the altar of military might, until there is acceptance by all that the nuclear age lies on the salvation of the nuclear age lies on the conference table, not on the battlefield.
Some months after Hammarskjöld's death, you were asked by the editor of a magazine in Sweden to write an article which would attempt to, quote, throw light not just on the public servant, but on the man himself.
Yes,
during
would
the last
you stop
days.
For a second?
Sure.
We're not
stopping now. We're recording.
Oh, sorry. Going back to what you were saying, don't you think it was quite a remarkable thing that the new Secretary General did in getting Spain and France together just last week?
Yes, but we don't want to bring him in it, do we?
No, but I mean, I was absolutely startled and amazed that he had been able to achieve this sort of thing. That was not what you were getting with Waldheim or anything that you've been getting in the last.
No, but this interview is about Dag Hammarskjöld.
I know, but are you not contrasting with other Secretary General or not?
Well, since I don't know the present one personally, I don't feel that I can comment on him very well.
Very good. I think that makes sense.
So let's get back, I think, to the original. Some months after Hammarskjöld's death, you were asked by the editor of a magazine in Sweden to write an article which would attempt to, quote, throw light not on just the public servant, but on a man himself, during the last days, weeks, and months of his life, unquote. I haven't seen the published article among your papers, but can you tell us what the gist of it was?
What I tried to say was that Dag Hammarskjöld was a very different person from the one known publicly, and one of his great differences was that he was a very religious person, almost a mystic. That, of course, came out later in his book, The Markings, his book called Markings. Dag Hammarskjöld, I had something in mind, wait a minute.
He wasn't religious in that he subscribed to any particular organized religion.
No, I think I better say that. He was not religious in the sense of belonging to some creed or church. His was more a universal kind of human brotherhood religion. And he brought it to bear on his concept of the meditation room at the United Nations, which we've already talked about.
We must soon bring this interview to a close. And I should like to ask you some questions of a more general nature. How would you evaluate Dag Hammarskjöld in his role as Secretary General of the United Nations?
Dag Hammarskjöld is identified more with the United Nations probably than any other Secretary General. He was a leader, and he gave the UN a role in peacemaking as well as in peacekeeping. And many of his initiatives in those two areas have lasted over until this day, although they haven't been carried out completely.
What were some of his most valuable or significant contributions to the organization?
Well, in peacemaking, he had a major role in trying to bring, to restore order to the Middle East during that period. And in peacekeeping, he had the distinction of helping to originate the UNIF operation, which separated Israel and Egypt, the military forces of Israel and Egypt. UNIF, United Nations Emergency Force, which was the first big peacekeeping operation of the United Nations, and set a standard for others.
Bonin, what do you personally most remember Hammershaw for?
I remember him very much as a man who had apparent solutions to many problems. Not complete solutions, but at least knew how to move them off dead center where a conflict was brewing. And that goes for many of the issues after he went to China to gain release of the American flyers. That was unique for a Secretary General. And after that, it seemed to me that we all expected him to do something about any of the major conflicts that were raging. And he did try. He wasn't always successful, but he did try.
How do you think the United Nations might have progressed differently if Hammershaw had lived on to serve one or more additional terms?
I don't think Hammershaw would have had another term, because the Soviet Union was already dead set against his staying in that office. He had turned out to be more than an administrative officer. He had taken the lead in trying to resolve some of the big problems before the world. And as a consequence, the Soviet Union didn't want anything to do with him, particularly after the Congo, when they felt that he was siding with the United States in the Congo and trying to keep the Soviet Union out.
As a final question, I would like you to read parts of a broadcast which you made for the NBC radio network on 17 September 1962, just 1 year after Hammershaw died.
I said at the time, 1 year has passed. In a tree-shaded churchyard in the old university town of Uppsala, Sweden, a simple granite headstone marks the resting place of a famous son between his parents, rooted over by a great slab with the one word Hammershaw engraved on it. There are always flowers on the grave, frequently a single white rose, sometimes a yellow rose, sometimes three yellow ones tied together, wreaths, blossoms of every season. In the distance is the red turreted castle where Dag Hammarskjöld grew up, and the university he attended, and the cathedral from which he was buried, and the tombs of the Viking kings. Another man will sit in the once vacant chair in the assembly podium. But this is the day of remembrance. After Dag Hammarskjöld's death, I received a copy of what must have been one of his last writings. It appeared in the magazine Together, a publication for Methodist families. When he wrote, what he wrote then is as pertinent for today, will be for many years to come. Here are Dag Hammarskjöld's words. The work for peace must be animated by tolerance, Dag Hammarskjöld said, and the work for human rights by respect for the individual. To some, the word tolerance may sound strange in a time of Cold War and negotiations from positions of strength. It may have an overtone of weakness or appeasement, and yet have we reason to believe, asked Hammarskjöld rhetorically, that what was there in the past is no longer true? It is not the weak, but the strong who practice tolerance, and the strong do not weaken their position in showing tolerance. On the contrary, only through tolerance can they justify their strength in the face of these counteracting forces that their own strength sets in motion. This holds true of all those in the present world situation who may be or may consider themselves to be strong, Dag Hammarskjöld said. Be it the industrialized West in relation to the underdeveloped countries, be it the powers whose military resources give them key positions, or be it those who have achieved a state of democracy toward which others are still groping. And he went on, heaven arms with pity those whom it would not see destroyed. Over the ages and over the continents, these words join in those of the psalmist, there is forgiveness with thee that thou mayest be feared. The words of Dag Hammarskjöld on this Memorial Day.
Thank you very much, Polly. Okay, so now what are we going to talk about informally?
Well, I suppose we want to talk about the characteristics of Dag Hammarskjöld and what sort of a legacy he left at the UN.
Yes, well, what about the characteristics of Hammarskjöld first, before the legacy?
Well, I once did a little piece about him in which I called Man Against Fear. Because it seemed to me that of all things, Dag Hammarskjöld was courageous in taking positions. And if he hadn't been, he wouldn't have gotten into trouble with the Soviet Union over the Congo. But he was very courageous because he thought that it was only right that the Congo should be saved for the future. And therefore, it was necessary to send in United Nations troops.
Yes, so far you talk about courage, but there are a number of other qualities besides, I would say, their integrity is an important one, and intelligence to the point of brilliance. What about some of those other attributes?
I think you have summed them up very nicely. That Dag Hammarskjöld certainly had a super intelligence, and he was a man of great integrity. It would be difficult to believe that he did anything underhanded in trying to bring nations together to try to solve some of these problems. And because of the fact that he was strong and courageous, and as he once told me, got out in front where he knew he'd be a target, that was the reason why he incurred the dislike of the Soviet Union and their effort to try to unseat him as Secretary General.
Lee, would you have any thing to ask on this particular issue?
I unfortunately have never met the gentleman. But he does seem to have stood out among all the Secretary General, and yet he must have been a very difficult man as far as a reporter is concerned.
Oh, exceedingly so. I said to him one day, you know, Mr. Secretary General, if you would only take a strong stand on some of these controversial issues that are coming up, you'd give us reporters something to do, we'd be able to report. And he said, well, I feel this way, that I'm like the parents of a wayward son who do not scold the son while he is in the midst of a crisis, but wait until that passes, and before he gets involved in another one, they try to reason with him and explain the facts of life. And I said, well, I asked, well, how does the bachelor know about these things? And he said, but I have nieces and nephews.
And didn't he also always refer to the UN as his family?
He referred to the UN as this house and gave it a family connotation every time he had a chance, especially in his speeches.
And then also I heard you say something about his temper. This is a man who preserved his cool in diplomatic relations, but he had to blow off steam occasionally. And who were the targets of that temper? His closest aides?
I don't know.
I don't think you could say targets of the temper, because the temper must have been directed against any other people besides his aides. But I know that he must have had people that he could sort of unload. And Pauline, you probably could remember better than I some of the people, certainly the ones next to him, like Cordier and Brian Urquhart and of course
the Indian.
Ralph Bunche.
The Indian, what was his name?
Narasimhan. Mm-hmm. Yeah, C.V. Narasimhan.
He had difficulty with him, didn't he?
Well, I don't know that you could say that C.V. had difficulty with Hammarskjöld, but I think that he was probably one of the people to whom Hammarskjöld was able to speak. But again, I say it would not be unloading his temper against them.
It's just blowing off steam over a particular situation.
In stark contrast to Kurt Waldheim, who was known to have terrible temper tantrums. well, we won't go into that for the purposes of this.
Yeah.
Well, I was thinking that whether he sounded off toward General de Gaulle or not, he and General de Gaulle did not see eye to eye on Algeria. And I would assume that someplace along the line some hot words were traded there. De Gaulle was the only head of state who didn't send condolences to the UN at the time of Dag Hammarskjöld's death.
Well, de Gaulle was known to be a character in his own right, but I think that what we're trying to talk about is Hammarskjöld, who was not simply a character, but a character who sacrificed, or not sacrificed, kept his own personal feelings down within a much larger discipline, which he was constantly aware of the needs and the welfare of other people, other interests. I think he was a self-sacrificing man.
Oh, it's almost saintly from what I'm hearing. Would you go that far, that he really believed
I think that would be unfair to him, but he was certainly absolutely unusual.
You could say that he was a mystic, if you want to go that far in the religious connotation.
And U Thant used to pride himself on being a mystic.
Yes.
And U Thant was another Secretary General whose personal integrity was not question.
Right? That's right. And he meditated every day as a Buddhist.
Did Hammarskjöld go down to the meditation room frequently of silence or anything?
I don't know whether he did alone or not.
No, but there's that one episode that you described earlier where he went down at 2 o'clock in the morning. And all his close colleagues thought that he wanted to go down to meditate or something like that. Whereas it turned out that he always took a very close, supervision of the creation of the meditation room. It was his own creation. It turned out that when they got down to the meditation room at 2 o'clock that morning, they found that he had a crew of painters at work. And Pauline told us about what he did, about supervising the painting.
But they had all-night crews at the UN, is that it?
No, not that there are certain services of the UN that are supposed to be working at all times. The Security Council, for example, is supposed to be available 24 hours a day, 365 or 66 days a year. So the Security Council is in continuous session. Now, when it's necessary, UN people at all levels are supposed to be at the disposal of the Secretary General 24 hours a day.
But I assume the cleaning crews are normally work at night. Is that right?
Oh yes, and it's done as you know, for reasons of economy and so forth, in the best way possible. But there are always times and exigencies of service circumstances which may require people to work at odd hours.
Mm-hmm. Norman, the cable office would be running all night, wouldn't it?
Oh yes, of course. Not only the cable office at headquarters, but all the multitudinous UN communications installations all over the world. It's all on a 24-hour day basis.
And especially when the Secretary General would be away.
When the Secretary General was away, he always kept in close contact, and I think this is the practice of all the Secretaries General with headquarters.
Am I wrong, but that terrible incident where at one point the U.S. had insisted on having clearance, security clearance, of all its people at the U.N. Do you remember?
Yes, indeed, I remember.
And Lee apparently had gone along with it. And did Hammarskjöld do anything about reversing that?
No, it didn't have to be reversed as far as I know. It was just an incident that the United States permitted its police force to enter the UN at any which was supposed to be
this was during the McCarthy era, as you'll remember, Pauline.
Supposed to be a secure enclave, not to be violated by any of the nations, but Henry Cabot Lodge headed the group that went into the United Nations to check on American employees to make sure they were loyal to the United States government.
What happened, as I recall, was that, and I remember because there was a meeting of the staff association at the time. It was Trigvi Lee who had given permission to the United States authorities, the FBI, I think it was, to conduct their investigations and their interrogations of American staff members right on the premises of the United Nations. This gave rise to a certain amount of indignation among the staff, non-Americans as well as the Americans.
Yes, and one member of the staff committed suicide over it, didn't he?
Yes, that was Abe Feller.
Yes.
He was a chief legal counsel. We don't know officially why he committed suicide, but it seemed fairly obvious that this terrible situation which had been fomented by the McCarthy and his supporters.
This intrusion into the United Nations was so unique that it had never happened before or since, as far as I know. But curiously enough, the Soviet Union, as far as I know, did not make any complaint about it, did it?
I'm not quite sure what you mean, Pauline. The Soviet Union has not made any complaint about what?
About invading
the American FBI going in.
Well, I can't remember anything official. But then perhaps they would like to do the same thing themselves.
Maybe they were already there.
I'm curious to wonder why you think that the UN is no longer held in such high regard.
Well, I tell you, Adlai Stevenson said when he was ambassador that if the UN was not in existence, it would have to be invented. But I think Stevenson was thinking about the UN as it should have been and was meant to be, rather than what it is. He didn't foresee the helplessness of the organization in trying to deal with international conflicts or threatened conflicts. It, of course, has become a valuable world hall as contrasted with town hall, where each nation has a right and does speak its piece. But if ever, nations agree to forego their emphasis on their own sovereignty to the detriment of the solution of international problems, the UN will never be achieve what it is was meant to be, that is, to try to solve some of the conflicts on the conference table instead of on the battlefield.
Well, you still feel that it will go on, but also it seemed to me that the nations were sending more highly respected people to represent them.
Oh, that was true.
In the old days than they are now. Now, it seemed to me that some of the best men were going there, or women.
That's perfectly true, Lee, and frequently the head of a delegation would be a foreign minister, and if it wasn't the head of delegation then, it wouldn't be long before, having served as foreign minister, he came back as a head delegate to the UN. So there were outstanding personalities at the UN in those days.
Well, you have to remember that in those days there were only 51 members of the United Nations, and it was immediately following the Second World War when so many people were hopeful that the world could achieve some of the aims and purposes of the United Nations as expressed in its charter. The charter still stands. But the enthusiasm about the United Nations, not only on the part of people who work for the UN, has been diluted by the tremendous increase in the size of the organization, both in membership and in the size of the staff. The Secretariat of the United Nations now is feeling that problem because of budgetary difficulties.
All the countries have to be represented, but is there any way that either of you can think of that they can be more effective, even though they are so large in membership?
Well, there's a great deal of criticism on the part of Americans who don't understand what the UN is all about. Criticism to the effect that these little nations like Zambia and Cyprus and so on have one vote, along with the United States, one vote. So that anything you tried to do to right that wrong would raise a huge howl of some kind, because everybody wants to have an equal voice, just as they do in the House of Representatives.
Well, have you any suggestions on what they might do? Or?
I haven't, but I know that one suggestion going around is called the Triad, which is supposed to be an effort to get all votes.
As distinct from the Troika.
That's right, which is what the Russians wanted to put in after Dag Hammarskjöld's death and even before his death. But the Triad is supposed to try to count votes in the General Assembly on the basis of population and economic strength and so on, so that the little nations wouldn't get the same kind of vote that the United States and the Soviet Union would have.
What do you think of that?
I don't think it will work.
Well, in any case, the little nations don't have the same kind of vote as the United States or the Soviet Union. plus the three other members of the permanent members of the Security Council. That difference in vote was considered at the beginning to be necessary in order to compensate for the enormous differences in size, power, and wealth of member nations. And that was long before. That was when the membership of the UN was about less than one third of what it is
yes.
now.
Mm-hmm.
But I think we're wandering away from
Hammarskjöld. Did Hammarskjöld ever talk about the ineffectiveness of having such a large constitution? What do you call it? Such a large membership.
I don't recall that he did, because he wouldn't attack the small nations, and they were the ones that really made up the overbalance of power.
No, in the very beginning, countries smaller than some of our present member states who applied for membership, like Monaco and
Holy See.
Hmm?
Holy See.
The Holy See is another one, but that's not quite
it
the same as the small states like Monaco and Liechtenstein, and there's a place between Andorra and little places
all
like
the places
that.
Where you go so to escape
I think
paying
they,
taxes.
They did apply for membership, but they were rejected on the grounds that they were too small. Now, of course.
Are they in now?
No.
Oh. They don't like to be twice spurned, is that it?
I don't know what the answer is to this problem. I'm not sure that it's a problem. It just means that if the small nations don't want something to pass in the General Assembly, they can stack up the votes against it.
Get this back to Hammarskjöld. What do you think Hammarskjöld might do about the United Nations and its present unhappy state of affairs if he were here and could do something about it?
Well, all I can say is that one time when he was talking about the Russians, Soviet Union, he said his greatest regret was that he wasn't able to do anything about the attitude of the Soviet Union. And he was asked